Well, we made our annual spring mission of hope to Sparkman's Nursery yesterday, and it got me thinking about this particular passage, a parable from Jesus recorded in Luke's Gospel. When a great crowd came together, and the people from town after town came to him, he said in a parable, "A sower went out to sow his seed, and as he sowed, some fell along the path and was trodden underfoot, and the birds of the air devoured it. And some fell on the rock, and as it grew up, it withered away because it had no moisture. And some fell among thorns, and the thorns grew with it and choked it. And some fell into good soil and grew and yielded 100-fold. Those who have ears to hear, let them hear." Well, as with any memorable Bible story or parable from Jesus, it is subject to quick and easy interpretation. And the quick and easy interpretation of the parable of the sower is simply this: make sure your soil is good. Watch out. Keep out the weeds from your life or God will get you. Or something to that effect. What I find most intriguing about this parable is that the sower, held up as a farmer of some worth, is really pretty reckless. Not very good at what he does, throwing the seed every which way without seemingly much care. You'd think he could have seen the rocks and the thorns and all of the other things where the seed has seemingly no chance. But he throws it with reckless abandon. And that, I think, is as much the point as anything else. The seed, which Jesus uses as a metaphor for the Word of God, is flung to the four winds with reckless abandon. And some of it comes back yielding 100-fold. Some of it. Well, it's not an unfamiliar concept. I teach freshmen, and we're now about halfway through the term, and at that point you begin to wonder whether, you know, what is it that you're doing that they're getting, or is it making any difference? I have appointments with two students Tuesday morning who now, after the third test, have sort of figured out that it might be useful to have a conversation with the professor about what they're not getting. I don't know whether they ever will get it, but we'll try. We'll keep going. People who send their kids off to college is a matter of great faith. You know, there's a significant amount of tuition dollars and emotional energy that goes into that. To what effect? Well, we hope, but, you know, quite frankly, the attrition rate is not trivial. In some ways, and at some levels, it's even higher than you might imagine. I've been at Tech now almost 17 years and been working in our graduate program where we provide the opportunity for students to get master's degrees, we hope many of whom will then go on to doctoral programs and wind up in the academy and so on, and wind up professors in other places. In the nearly 17 years I've been there, I can name 5 or 6 who have done that. Now, many others have graduated and have done other things, but in terms of actually doing what it is that our program is constituted to produce, very few. One of them is your son, the doctor, now at UT Permian Basin, and we are very proud of that. But it's unusual, because some, even of what we do, falls among the thorns and among the rocks. Every once in a while, I'll get a note from a former student or someone who's been in my class some years back that will say, you know, I remembered this or I remembered that, and on the basis of what you said, this happened. I got an invitation this week to speak to a group of students for whom one of my former students is the RA in the dorm, and she wants me to tell some of them what she learned a few years back. So on occasion, things come back. Occasionally enough to make the effort worth it? Parallel to this passage is a note from the prophecy of Isaiah. Now, Isaiah's prophecy is the same prophecy that foretold the birth of Christ, foretold the restoration of Jerusalem, and in some ways summarizes those sentiments in a passage from near the end of the book, chapter 55. "For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and return not thither but water the earth, making it bring forth and sprout, giving seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth." And here's the promise: "It shall not return to me empty. It shall accomplish that which I purpose and prosper in the thing for which I sent it." It shall not return to me empty. Maybe in ways that you can't imagine or couldn't predict. Our good friend and leader in our church, Giles McCrary, has lived a good and long life and has been honored in many, many, many ways for some of the things that he has done, most of which embarrass him. But on occasion, something happens to him for which he understands that what he has done has been honorable and has been useful. And probably none of those things of which you are well aware would fall into that category. But 4 or 5 years ago, he told me a story after having been hospitalized for a week or so. And this was just a conversation that he had one-on-one with me. He said, I don't know if you remember, but that charge nurse that was in the room when you were visiting a couple of days in, that particular nurse told me, and I didn't know it, that she had been a recipient of a Texas Tech scholarship through the Franklin Trust. And now, as a charge nurse, she was taking care of him. And as he told me that story, it made him more than just a little bit emotional to know that something of what he was, over which he was steward in some sense, generated that rate of return. That word did not return to him empty. Most of us don't have that kind of direct evidence of what we do. But enough of us have enough evidence to know that the promise is still true. What we do, and in the ways in which we do it, at least from time to time, yields 100-fold. Which is not to say it always does. All of us have thorns and rocks and dry soil in our lives, metaphorically. I think of a story I tell on myself, not an especially edifying one, but told every semester to my students when we talk about the power of group dynamics. All of us, in the company of other people, will do things that we would never do individually, but for the pressure of, or seemingly commitment to, or desire to be a part of a group. Now, in a very positive way, churches do that. We are groups of people that together are greater than the sum of our parts. So also are cliques and groups in schools. In seventh grade, I was not the most popular kid in homeroom. I was smaller of stature than the really cool guys, not as athletic, probably seen by others as a cut above average in intelligence, big thick glasses, and the early stages of developing what is now an exquisitely precise and entertaining sense of humor. But in seventh grade, it was just sarcastic and annoying. So that generated unpleasantness from the popular kids to me on a more or less weekly basis. Well, the popular kids pick their targets, and their targets vary. And one particular day in seventh grade homeroom, I remember that I was not the target. The target was one of those typical kids that the creators of South Park have sort of put into our culture. You know, there's the rich kid, the fat kid, the poor kid, and the smart kid. Well, this particular day in homeroom, the target of the popular kids was the fat kid, who, if he had known or had any sense of self at all, had it not been eroded over time, could have just taken us all out of his misery, but he didn't. In fact, the abuse heaped upon him that day caused him to weep. And on that particular day, because the target wasn't me, and because I courted the attention of the popular kids, I joined in. This kid, to whom our energy was directed in a terribly destructive way, is one of maybe two classmates from that time whose name I remember. And I remember it from time to time when I tell the story, illustrating group dynamics, obviously. But also, now and then, his name floats through my head when I get just a little bit too full of myself. You know, what a good boy am I? Well, wait a minute. Remember that day with, you know? And all of us have that. Now, whether in some sense that redeems the word that fell to me that day and landed in the middle of a rocky head, hard to say. But in fact, we're all in the same boat. And even so we press on. What is it that we are called to do? We are called to leave it better than we found it. The season of Lent gives us the opportunity to reflect on our own failings and shortcomings, but also on our gifts and opportunities. Can we leave it better than we found it in any significant way? Hard to say. The promise is that his word will not return empty. But what is it that generates the wit and the will to keep trying? Another story that I have rattling around in my head that I use toward the end of the classes that I teach, because the classes that I teach often illustrate some of the really intractable difficulties in our lives: poverty, inequality, injustice, ethnocentrism, racism, all of this stuff that continues to infect our world collectively and relationships individually. And it raises the question, can any individual make much of a difference at all? And to address that question, I sometimes use this little metaphorical story that I suspect I've told you before, but hey, I've read you the parable of the sower before too, so we'll just deal with it. It metaphorically involves a guy on vacation living in a beach house for a week. And at a time when, through the vagaries of weather and so on, the ocean is washed up on shore, hundreds, perhaps, of starfish. And on his morning walk, which people who vacation on the beach tend to do, from time to time he bends down, picks up a starfish, and flings it back into the sea, thereby saving its life, at least temporarily. Certainly he's not throwing them all in. He's throwing one in periodically. Someone watching coming from the other direction stops, notices he's been doing this, and says to him, "You know what? You're really not doing anything that's making much of a difference. How much difference can you make by just occasionally doing this?" The guy says, "Nothing." He simply reaches down, picks up another starfish, and throws it back in the sea, and says, "Made a difference to that one." Made a difference to that one. That's all it is that we are called to do. Bolstered by the promise that from time to time and on occasion, the word will return a hundredfold. To make a difference to that one. To be aware in our lives when the opportunity presents itself to be of use, to be more gentle than we might have otherwise, to withhold criticism that seems well-deserved. To be perhaps more generous than we might have been had this not occurred to us. Starting this past Monday, with the return of the vernal equinox, each day gives us another minute or two of daylight. And that will be the case until mid-June. So for the next 2 or 3 months, including the rest of Lent, imagine the opportunity that comes, not just with each new day, but with the additional minute or two of daylight in each new day, to toss a starfish, metaphorically. That is the charge of Lent today. What are we supposed to be about as God's people in God's world? Well, from time to time, and when the situation presents itself, or maybe even when you look for a situation for which this might occur, tossing a starfish is all we're asked to be about. And in return, we have the never-failing promise from the same prophecy that gave us the promise of and the reality of the restoration of Jerusalem, the promise and the reality of the birth of Christ. Tossing a starfish, the word that goes forth will not return to him empty, but that today just might be a day when you become an instrument of his peace. Amen.